This is the AdNonTech Podcast, conversations about education, technology, and culture, with Dr. Doug Reed and Dr. Matt Stranick. Thank you for joining us. My name is Matt Stranick, and again, I am awfully, deeply, significantly pleased, thrilled, and stoked to be in conversation with some very high-profile guests in the realm of e-learning lately. We have been upping our game significantly in this regard in terms of expanding the format, and this is absolutely no exception. I am absolutely thrilled, stoked, and all those other superlatives that I just used with an exponential factor, sir, to join Dr. John Braun of Athabasca University, a very long-term and serious presence, to use a term, within our e-learning academic and professional and the sort of areas that John has been involved in over the decades in the distance education areas, including his academic work, but then also significant community of supporting and building work and publishing and writing and all of those things. Above and beyond all that, he has a very significant, eclectic website, which I encourage everybody to check out. And he's also the author of a really excellent new practical, I dare say, enjoyable to read. Can I use that term, sir? And the name of that book is How Education Works, and it is out on Athabasca University Press. Oh, the coveted hard copy of the AU book. I'd be remiss to my potential audience for this show not to indicate that you can visit and get a awesomely up, a high quality free PDF, an OER, if you will, which I'm sure we're going to get into because I'm absolutely chuffed to hear John's thoughts about OER among many other endeavors. We are going to stick to the book as much as possible because certainly there's a lot there, and that's what my interest would be. John, thank you so much for being here, sir. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Matt. But I'd a serious contribution. I've made frivolous contributions. I think that's...
Well, but, as we all know, informal learning is, where it starts, right? Play, engagement, curiosity, the low or non-existent stakes that sort of give you the self-efficacy. So, again, speaking... within the realm of the show, we've been trying to open it up. So we've had people like, authors of, various kinds. And, over at the music podcast, we've been kind of speaking to people from various areas of creativity. But when I'm strictly speaking in the areas of, learning design, curriculum, educational technology, all these sort of ancillary and yet not mutually exclusive areas that are in our field, my ears just prick up because I haven't looked at my doctoral thesis in a while, but I did punch it up at the University of Calgary Archives, and I cited your work on I was doing my work on MOOCs, so if you can just sort of forgive me for that. But your work, along with Terry Anderson, notably but not exclusively, came up within that. I defended 17. So you came up 15 times within, a 200-page document. And, I really just have to say that your work, particularly on the third generation of digital pedagogy, or the three generations, sorry, I don't mean to fanboy here. I'm going to let you talk to sort of, to paraphrase Kanye West interrupting Taylor Swift that time. Sir, my opening gambit for the show is typically, you know, who is John and what are you about within the realm of your professional work and beyond that, sir, just for the people at home who are not fortunate.
Who is John? That's a question that I would love to know the answer to, and I've spent 63 years trying to find it, and I'm not sure what it is yet. But I'm a grandfather, and I live in Vancouver near my grandchildren, and I have had a slightly eclectic career that has led me to the place that I'm in. But I think I am. The stuff that interests me is the stuff that happens on the boundaries. It's the stuff that happens on the borders between different things. So I have what I guess you could call a little bit of a butterfly mind. I know very little about a very large number of things. the work that I have done...
A John of all trade, folks. You heard it here first. He is a John of all trade. Sorry, just... Capture that thought while it tweaked past. I apologize, sir. Please continue.
It was a good thought. I like it, Matt. But yes, except that, you know, that sort of suggests that I can actually do any of these things, and I can't. But that's actually, I think that's my magic skill. That is the one where I can... I like to connect things. I like to see where things join up. And so the level of detail, I have attempted to get a diagnosis of ADHD, but apparently I'm kind of borderline, so I don't actually have that. But I do have that.
You heard it here first from the, we're I have to sort of mine the moment for like clickable exclusive content here. So if I can just sort of, you know, John Drawn, you know, have you heard the word about John Drawn and his attempt to get an ADHD diagnosis?
Failed ADHD, yes.
It's just an uphill struggle, my friend, I mean, as you well know, so.
ADHD in all but dissertation, yeah, that's so, but I do have that thing where I can disappear down rabbit holes for a while, and be terribly, terribly highly focused, but most of the but I can be so easily distracted from that, and I think that kind of helps us. I mean, that sort of defines my career, and certainly the kinds of things that have gone into my writing. Because if I've had any success at all in that, I think it is because, rather than drilling through the same thing for a decade, I've found things to pull together.
And again, that is so legit and so interesting. And I think, you know, a theme that sort of keeps coming up as Doug and I, the inestimable Dr. Doug Reed, who would have preferred to be here today but can't, has often mentioned, and I've often mentioned, that it just seems like in our space, the area that we kind of work at, it seems that people come from all sorts of disciplinary positions and orientations. It's seldom, you know, what they started in. There's always sort of a pre sort of a teaching sort of career almost to sort of segue into it. And just sort of through a matter of sort of what a bricolage, to use a term, picking up the conceptual frameworks and pieces and curricular elements, and in true constructivist or constructionist fashion, right, kind of using what will serve, you know, the students, your learners, most effectively in the moment. So I think what you're referring to kind of speaks to that a bit. Again, please correct me, sir, if I'm mistaken any of that, because who am I to speak to constructivism or any of it? I defer to my senior colleague on this, sir.
Well, senior in years, yes. It is. I mean, it has been a career-defining thing for me. It's the reason I'm a professor in a School of Computing and Information Systems, and the reason I'm in a School of Computing and Information Systems is not because I'm find the subject immensely fascinating. Not computers per se. I mean, I'm a geek. I've got probably 13 computers around me here. But you know, that's not actually the thing that interests me. I'm definitely not a computer scientist. I'm in computing because it's not a real subject. It's a subject where you can get to work with anybody about anything. And as long as there's a computer involved, which of course there is because it's the 21st century, then really, you know, and the same, I think, applies to some extent to education. I have been drawn to moving into some kind of center or department of education for two or three decades, I mean, almost my entire teaching career, because it's the thing that really I like most. It's that application of computers to learning is the thing which fascinates me immensely. But again, it has the same thing. If you're in a field of education, then you're in many other fields at the same time. Well, at least probably one or two others. Again, is it a real discipline? Maybe education is, but definitely learning technology and educational technology isn't. It's a synthetic field.
I like this. You're not equivocating, and I'm sorry to horn in, sir, but I mean, just again, sort of for the person who's, you know, potentially outside our disciplinary orientation whatsoever, because again, in keeping with trying to expand the format of the show, I am going to sort of put a pin on this. We don't have to spend a huge amount of time on this because I actually have a bunch of other stuff I do want to get to in our limited and respectful time together. To say education is a field, okay, awesome, legit, and that education is not, or educational technology and learning design are not a field. Sir, those are some significant statements, which I look forward to. I'm going to let you talk to delineate that a little bit. But again, if I can just sort of back up, because you've been talking about, you know, the decades in your career, I am interested in exploring across these series of chats with people, you know, like what the home environment factored into it. It's not to get all, you know, like were your parents like, you know, college educated? Were they professional people? I mean, what was it like that sort of I can remember, for instance, in growing up in the mid-90s, you know, as a teenager, when like the first laptop computer from my mom's job entered the home. And I just remember thinking, okay, this is making everything else around it different now. So again, I just sort of wonder what the home environment for you was like. And then ultimately, just to briefly, what led you through to where area?
Aha. Okay, well, I'd probably have to go back a fair distance on that one. So, yeah, I got a child of the 60s, and I did grow up in a family of teachers. I was one of five children. My father was a headmaster.
Whereabouts? Like a principal. Sorry, I got to ask just on behalf of the people who don't know you, whereabouts, when you're talking about where you were born and where you were raised.
I was born in England. I am a man of Kent, if you want to be very precise about it. But we moved around quite a bit when I was. I am.
Awesome.
It's something to do with being born on one side or the other of the Medway. Anyway, whatever that is, with a father who was a headmaster, we moved around a fair bit every time my father got a new school. He was a slightly radical headmaster for the 60s and one of the youngest ones who'd ever got a job.
Awesome.
But neither of my parents had degrees. They'd been teenagers and young people during the Second World War, so they kind of missed out on a lot of that educational process. My father did get to go to art college and from there became a teacher, but that's
what subject did he teach besides being a headmaster? What was his disciplinary arts?
Yeah. Well, he started as an art teacher, but and he was an artist, and he I actually, we moved house about 3 months ago, and I still don't have pictures up on the wall. But we, I sometimes have his pictures on the wall. Oh, actually, I can.
Awesome.
We move my camera up. There's the red brick thing behind me.
Oh.
Was once a red brick, and that was one of my father's sculptures. It's of my mother, which is kind of a weird thing to have. So there's not much that I have of his.
That's radical, man. That's awesome. And I'm sorry to sort of horn in on the conversation and kind of steer you into a digression here. But it sounds like you had all the resources around you for sort of for literacy, you know, and with a teaching, you know, family, you know, you're always going to have the lights on. You're not going to have like a great, you know, like you're not going to be rich. You're not going to be affluent. But, you know, you'll sort of get by in the community where you're assigned to teach. It sounds like is kind of. Is that sort of not accurate, or
it's pretty much true? And I'm very much the youngest of five kids, and my I think the first one to become a teacher was my second oldest sister. My oldest sister actually never became a teacher of such, but she worked in schools as lab technician and stuff. My big brother was ran a windsurfing school for some years. My other brother, again, not really a teacher, more of a he used to think of the Dole, the unemployment benefit, as being the modern benefactor of the arts. He was an artist, but he did do odd bits of teaching. My mother became a teacher later in life when I was fairly young child. She taught at a college, she got a degree eventually at the age of about 77, I think it was, Open University degree in the UK.
Wow.
She was very proud of that.
That is like a cool family accomplishment for every one of you in your own respective way. See, I'm the first person in my family to go into any of this. And, you know, it's just like, whatever. I'm always interested. Like Doug, the esteemed Dr. Doug Reed, his family, both his parents were teachers. And in fact, his grandparents were teachers as well. So, I mean, there was just no hope for him, right? As far as that goes. Right. So can I just then sort of then kind of go to you're spending this time. You're a man of Kent. You're growing up in this household. I mean, do you remember having like any was like education like a cool thing for you? And when did you sort of know that you were going to be in university as kind of for the long term? When did that sort of land for you?
Happened, at the end of my school, I went to university because I knew it was a fun thing to do. My next brother up had gone to art college, and he seemed to be having fun, and it seemed like since I had no idea what I wanted to do, I it seemed like you used to get grants in those days. You know, I used to had money to go to university, and all of my fees were paid, and I could even claim dole during the vacations. You know, so it was a very different kind of a world.
Wow. Is that under a Labour government, can I ask? That was
was that what?
Was that under a Labour government then? Because I sort of associate Thatcher with like sort of cutting that stuff. I mean, again, I'm trying to sort of remember the era kind of a bit. Not that it matters at all as a salient point, even a bit. It sounds like a remarkable opportunity. And it sounds that, you know, being able to having a government that sort of steps back and goes, okay, let's actually make some investments in the knowledge sector 5 years in advance and then see where we end up or 10 years in advance. That kind of enlightened public policy, I regret to say, it's rare in North America, non-existent from my estimation, not to be nihilist about it. Is something that really seems to have worked out well for you in your present trajectory, if I can put it that way, sir.
Yeah, sure. And I mean, there are plenty of countries in the world where there is still exactly that kind of investment. You can just go to Scotland today, and it's I think at least they don't you don't have to pay fees if you're Scottish. Germany, your education will be funded as far as it goes. And I'm not sure. It is something that has changed very much in my lifetime. When my own kids went to university, we had to pay some or all of their fees. I think nowadays in the UK, it's worse than here, I would say, probably, or very similar at any rate. And it is such a ridiculous thing, because education is not about individual good. It's not about these whole notions of having to sort of pay back for the education you got because of the advantages it gave you. No, it gives advantages to everybody. It brings everybody up to an educated society. It's more peaceful, they're more prosperous, they're healthier. Pretty much everything about them is a good thing. It's an investment for social good. It's not an investment for individual progress. And I think it's often got tied up with that rather peculiar notion that education is something that you do in order to benefit employers. That's not it. Employers are among the beneficiaries for sure, but again, it's about improving the society that we live in and improving it for everybody, even those who don't get the coolest bits of education. You know, it's a providing opportunities for those who can. So yeah, I think it was a really good thing, and it was probably partly why, you know, because I wasn't thinking of it as being a career move in any way. I had no idea what career I wanted to do apart from not becoming a teacher. I did a degree in philosophy. I'd actually intended originally to do a degree in philosophy with literature. That was, and when I'd originally applied for things, I did that. But I discovered that the university that I really wanted to go to, it was slightly easier to get into a philosophy degree than a philosophy with literature degree, and B, I could actually wind up doing more literature. Awesome. Because it had a kind of modularized system that actually meant that, due to peculiarities of the bureaucratic system, that you actually wound up doing, studying.
That is so rad. I have to interject. I have to interject simply because for my own sort of interesting ruminations here, in as much as I did my BA with a focus on English and with a minor in philosophy. And the only reason I didn't do a double major was because I think there was a really pretty, attractive young woman who was taking like the Irish film class or something that sort of kind of tipped the ratio over. I just ended up taking like, you know, well, I'm taking all these courses anyway. And so that is absolutely cool, though, because I always feel very strongly. We spoke with Stephen Downs last week. And so if you're talking about somebody in our area, our e-learning space, who really, you know, prioritizes, shall we say, the philosophy underpinnings of what he's doing. I mean, he takes that stuff seriously. I mean, I would say, Stephen, please email me if I'm getting this wrong, but the philosophical enterprise is paramount, and then the other stuff kind of sort of attends after, almost. So I don't want you to go like full, you know, Didera or postmodernist here, sir. But I mean, who did you study for philosophers? Who did you enjoy, and who resonates for you now, particularly within our space, if I can ask you that?
Yeah, that's a very it's an interesting question, and I'd kind of say loads, but actually my favorite philosopher has always been J.L. Austin. I love J.L. Austin. He had such good titles for his papers. I mean, Three Ways of Spilling Ink, I think, was one of my favorites, which is It was somewhat to do with dismantling language, but it was in the process of getting the insights for the way in which we understand the world and our place in it and the nature of ethics and our relationships with one another. So I always kind of liked J.L. Austin. He was my fave. I think more it's about the philosophy gave I really didn't study terribly hard. I spent most of my time in clubs, and things like folk clubs and jazz clubs and singing stuff. And I was in
so
how many theatrical productions?
I'm so there with you on that. Folks,
the early music society, I was even, because I got to play with they had a bass recorder, and I couldn't afford a bass recorder, so if I joined the early music society, I could play the bass recorder, and I did a kind of weird bluesy thing with it. The photography society, I joined that one because I was an avid photographer back in those days. I studied it independently at school and wound up getting an art prize for it, which was bizarre because it wasn't an art qualification. Anyway, but again, you know, that gave me access to a dark room. It wasn't that I liked joining societies. I really don't. I'm very Groucho-like in my society joining. But I didn't really spend much time doing philosophy, but I did. I think it did help to reinforce a frame of mind and an attitude to the ways of thinking about the world. I did find philosophy fascinating. It fascinated me for some years, and I think it's such a pity it wasn't taught in school in those days because it's such a useful skill. But of course, at the time, this was Thatcher's Britain, and my first election that I could vote in, that was the election Thatcher got in. So I think at the time I graduated, over 50% of philosophers were unemployed a year after graduation, and 25% of people with philosophy degrees were unemployed at any one time overall. So obviously I became a musician. Because I'd been doing this throughout, especially the year of my final year, I'd been singing to supplement my grant, which I was allowed to do. That was the thing. Really, probably just the fueled my cannabis consumption, really. But it was I went on to become a singer for the next 10 years, really, as a full-time occupation, and for about 20 years as a part-time occupation. So it was that helped a lot, I think, in the way informing my ideas about learning and stuff. And partly it was the practical stuff about understanding how people behave as crowds and as audiences, and knowing how you can play with that. Partly it's about understanding how learning happens in informal settings without anyone having to do any teaching. And I think that's kind of at least I say that, and I don't know if we'll have time to reach the book. And kind of the point is that, of course, there's a huge amount of teaching going on in any context. And you and I are teaching one another now, and we're surrounded by stuff that's teaching us. So, I mean, that's to say that we're self-taught is radically wrong. But to say that teaching happens within any social context, and even any asocial context, I think is fairly fair. Anyway, I got bored with that. Got very bored with singing, and somewhere about the early 90s.
You got bored with singing. I'm sorry. It's the Atlantic Canadian in me. I just kind of have to horn in because just simply, sir, there's a lot that you've spoken to that I think a lot of us can relate to. And I think it's sort of, you know, the kind of like wayward sort of first degree. And like, you know, for me, that was characterized by working full time in restaurants, you know, and thinking very highly of my literary art, which nobody else did. But, you know, that was OK. And, you know, like my friends, you know, they were into musical pursuits. I'm a lifelong music fan. There's a whole parallel music endeavor that goes along with the show right over at the New Brunswick Today, New Brunswick Tomorrow, the World podcast. And so as a lifelong fan of music and hearing you say, like from your perspective, your vantage point over the years as somebody who's of a significant role at a significantly known preeminent Canadian, thereby, you know, international institution, you know, to hear you sort of say, well, you know, the first degree, and it's like, man, that was my experience too. And so many people, I think, have that. And I think as well, you know, your passion is sort of what sustains you in these other areas. So what you've described as informal learning variously and across your publication records. And I mean, that's for me, like the MOOC stuff that I kind of found interesting, you know, the quote unquote learning engagement pieces of it. You know, it's like, well, you find what motivates people and sort of try and reach them where they are so that they have the self-efficacy to sort of step up and you build something new in the moment that is authentic and reflects, you know, it's a product of a process. And I appreciate how you sort of link, you know, the philosophy, you know, the informal learning, you know, there's so much emphasis on the tech aspects of what we do. So I was very pleased when your opening remarks, when you just sort of said, you know, it's a area of sort of very loosely ad hoc kind of roles and skills, which you sort of attend to from a certain standpoint. The teaching is all the other stuff that, you know, is there. Am I trying to sort of catch it up for myself here? And if I'm sort of mischaracterized any of that, I'd be pleased to know. And just because, sir, we are at the 30-minute mark, and I promised you this would be a 40-minute chat at the most, I would love for you after that to say anything at all whatsoever about the book that would recommend it to people who maybe don't have advanced degrees in education or decades of experience like you and myself.
Well, the book explains all of that, basically.
Awesome.
It also explains why I got bored with music, because that was it wasn't I was doing it for the money, and that replaced the love that I had of it. And there is a similar issue with doing things for the grades, doing things for the credentials, which is highly destructive to the love of learning. I mean, given that learning is the thing that as babies kicking and screaming from the womb, the first thing we do is to learn. You know, that it's the thing that is most human. I mean, more than sex. And so the fact that we can build educational systems that actually take away that love is a huge and fundamental problem, and certainly our motivation has become one of the things that I find most interesting about it. And I'm most interested, I guess, in the book. It sort of stems from, in fact, when I look back on even going back to my PhD thesis 25 years ago or thereabouts, I was trying to explore the same kinds of themes about the relationship between structure and behavior and the reciprocal and deeply entangled relationship. It's complex system stuff. And it's the peculiar things that inspired me to write this, but like the notion that we build systems for education that are actually anti-educational, and that a lot of the things that we do to that we think of as being great pedagogy are actually just ways of dealing with the problems caused by the way in which we teach and the
reactionary or the ways in nature. May I use that word, sir? Reactionary. Our current approaches are largely defined as reaction to problems,
okay,
rather than sort of thinking, what's the best way to actually teach people? Full stop. It's sort of like under X, Y, or Z extenuating factor. And again, like Doug and myself, we are always about, you know, to the effect that essentially, you know, it's like procurement decisions are made at a very top down, you know, sort of level, it seems. No disrespect to administrators or the people involved. It's a worthy effort. But then it's just sort of like, it's like the dog is being wagged by the tail, right? When you have procurement decisions and like, here's the platform, and now let's make the teaching conform to the platform, the affordances and constraints and whatnot. So what I appreciate is what you're talking about is the opposite of that, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the platform goes back to the medieval times. I mean, the platform is, I mean, I used to build learning management systems in the 90s, and I know the thinking that goes into them, and it's basically you will automate the stuff that you perceive, the functions that you perceive happening within the traditional educational environment. And of course, those functions are simply counter technologies that are designed to deal with the fact that they're essentially based upon the scarcity of books and scholars and the simplicity of the effectiveness of lectures as a way of indoctrinating people back 1,000 years ago. And in fairness, they were pretty good and effective things. And this is, I mean, the book looks at all of this in technological terms, because all of these things, including methods of teaching, the ways in which we do things are technologies. And some of those technologies are really quite constraining and restrictive. So, for example, the learning management system, it embeds things like roles within the system, which mean that the teacher is always in control. In the classroom, the teacher can give up control. Online in a learning management system, they never can, because it's embedded in the design of the system. In a classroom, anybody can talk with anybody at any time, if that's the way you set it up to make it possible. And in a learning management system, you go somewhere else to do that, and that's just weird. So there's lots of real basic things about the ways in which we shape our dwellings, and afterwards our dwellings shape our lives. That's my favorite quote that's been in most presentations I've given for the last however long I've been an academic. Winston Churchill, Earl McLuhan, similar. Actually, it wasn't McLuhan, it was his friend Culkin, Reverend Culkin, who said, we shape our tools, and thereafter our tools shape us. And to some extent, it is true.
It's a very useful quote. That's a very good quote. That's an awesome quote, sir.
Well, it's been said in lots of different ways by lots of different people going back for actually probably thousands of years. But, certainly you can find very similar ideas in Marx. You can find very similar ideas in Dewey. It's the ways we express those ideas. The basic principle that we do is determined by what has been done by ourselves and others. And that is, again, pretty much the message of the book is how that happens. And I think of it in technological terms as seeing this as being, and technologies include poems, include words, include painting and whatever, as much as it includes learning management systems and things with flashing lights that are adorning my desk in front of me here. And it's not about the individual parts. It's about how the parts are put together and the roles that we play in putting those parts together. That is the thing that matters. And we have a very bad tendency to talk about, and this is why EdTech isn't a subject. Well, one of the many reasons EdTech isn't a subject, because when we talk about EdTech, we tend to mean it's stuff with flashing lights that's somehow related to education. And that's actually not the relevant part of it. All education is educational technology. Everybody is a learning technologist. The whole world you cannot live as a human being without being a learning technologist. It's just we choose different technologies to learn with. And it's all about the way in which we and others around us assemble those. It is a wonderfully, massively complex, glorious, creative process, but it can go horribly wrong for all sorts of reasons, which if we had more time, I would tell you all about. But it's all in there.
I'm just sitting here thinking about all the sort of synapse pops that I just sort of had, as what you were talking about. It's clear that there's no lack of phrases we could pull from this show. Everyone is a learning technologist. That is absolutely, I could put that on a t-shirt. I could sort of have a USB thing on the back of the shirt, or QR code rather. It would be, yeah. Everything you're describing, sir, it comes from such a place, it sounds like, of care, interest, passion. Your grandfather now, you're sort of at the sort of very high position within Athabasca. I was speaking with an individual, a writer, a couple days ago for the show, who now gets to call himself Professor Emeritus within his role, like he's officially emeritus now. I wonder if there's a future a point of John sort of stepping away from the formal academic endeavor and into other areas anytime soon. And I guess that's also sort of my kind of impromptu, low-key, but nevertheless obvious way of giving you the floor to shout out any individuals, efforts, or initiatives on the final descent for the conversation, sir.
Honestly, no, not really. What's happening next in my life is in my academic life is there is a follow-up book. When I wrote this one, it actually took about 10 years from the point at which I submitted a first draft. It was then called How Learning Technologies Work. But to the point at which it was published, I mean, 3 years of those admittedly were spent with the publisher itself. So I finished writing it 4 years ago, more or less. And in the process, I had actually written several books. And there's enough that's left over from this one, if I can ever figure out which bits I haven't used yet.
Several books.
Into another. Well, it's very easy to write a million words. You know, the tricky part is unwriting those million, choosing the words and putting them in the right order. Those are that's the difficulty I find with writing. I can write until the cows come home, but unwriting is the big problem. And that's just like, I mean, it's the same with teaching. You know, the teaching isn't the problem. Unteaching is a problem. You can easily learn, but it's very, very hard to unlearn. And it's very hard to lose habits of mind and ways of thinking about stuff that... So that's what I what I'm going to be doing from now on is unteaching, unwriting, unresearching. And unlearning what I've learned, and hopefully that'll be useful. I think there's a lovely thing that Clay Shirky has. This he talks about the Bayesian advantage of youth, and it's this thing that when you're when you're a beginner in something, you don't know what's impossible, and just every now and then you therefore do things that people who are experts think are impossible. And I want to be that perpetual beginner. That's how I want to carry on living my life as somebody who doesn't know and doesn't believe that they know, and who just wants to see the world afresh. And I think that would be a good thing.
Well, and again, like that's me throwing up the devil horns, in true punk rock fashion, because like I've got punk tattoos and just this whole identity associated with alternative music. And so, when I'm, that's like, a high term of respect here in my, little bizarre subculture, which somehow I think you can potentially relate to across your endeavors over the year, if not the specific content, then certainly the, wider human milieu associated with the lives and passions of musicians. And this has really been, I've just been trying to stop myself because you've just got so many rad phrases that you've just given us here for the show. And at some point, I'm hoping we have the opportunity to scrape this whole, unwieldy website and all the stuff and turn it into, a book format of some sort. And we've got like phrases of the podcast. The inestimable Dr. Doug Reed is always on about, he's not always on about it, but he makes a point of getting a question, a word, and a phrase. And you have just, with the unlearning, unteaching, and unwriting, have absolutely, I don't know, man, I think that's a summer vibe. I think that's the summer academic vibe that we all need. And I'm going to thank you very sincerely for putting that into the show notes. So, John, I could not be more grateful. And in all seriousness, I wish we had an hour and a half where we could just talk about this stuff, because I think personal passion about the arts, interest in language and ideas and the intersections of these in every moment of everyday life, mediated by technology, is a process. People think of technology as just like, it's the hardware, it's the app. It's like, it is so none of that. It is what happens. And, you know, sentience into actions that respond. You know, that is essentially what technology is. Anything that gets you, you know, and to further up the elevator, you know, the evolutionary tree, so that you're not eaten by a wombat or whatnot, right? I mean, it's what we've been conditioned to do.
Pretty much what it's about. Franklin talks about it being a fish and it's both fish and water. You know, that's the thing about it. And Kevin Kelly, it's both a noun and a verb. The technology is something we do. My definition is how we organize stuff to do stuff, which is derived from Brian Arthur's orchestration of phenomena to our use. But I think organizing stuff to do stuff, actually, you know, it is both the organization of it and what has been organized, and the stuff is part of what has been organized. And so it's very recursive, and
So wish that we had twice the time that we do. John, it has been an absolute slice. I'm so grateful for you being here. Thank you very much. Is there anything else you wanted to say about the book or anything else before I end the recording, sir?
No, read it, cite it, buy it. If you buy it, it's nice. I get a little bit of money for that, but you don't have to, because it's free to download, and you can read it also free online, chapter by chapter. And it's I believe that it's about making knowledge in the world, and obviously it has to be open. So,
and it's a beautiful hand, you know, the physical product is beautiful. I live with ebooks because I have to, but I would personally, as an English major, I love the tactile experience of having that in my hand. And I believe you have that right in front of you. It's got that new book smell, doesn't it?
Yep. Totally. The smell of ink. Fantastic smell. And the fact that it's a physical object that you can hold, and I can give this as a physical object to somebody, and I can leave this to my children. I can't leave the ebook version to my children. Mind you, I can give it to them without making a dent in my bank account.
I recommend everybody read this on the beach while you are relaxing and also doing your professional and personal development, because this is going to change the way you look at teaching. It's extremely informative. John is a world-renowned expert. He has colleagues who are world-renowned experts. Athabasca is the premier distance institution of learning in Canada. And I don't think there's anybody who can seriously contest that at all. Home of the International review of distance and distributed learning, Iridol, the seminal peer-reviewed high impact factor distance journal of education and associated endeavors. We didn't get into any of that whatsoever, but again, totally worth checking out. Athabasca has done such an amazing, fantastic job through various venues, formats, programs, and really setting the bar, I think, for what the rest of the sector, you know, tries to aspire to when it's doing its best. And I know it's, you know, got it, every place has its issues. But again, I just really wanted to, for my part, end out with a major shout out of respect to you, your colleagues, and your institution. And just thanks for being here and sharing all of this with us, sir. It really does mean a lot.
Thank you, Matt. It's been fun.
Awesome. Take care, everybody. Bye for now.